talk to Arabs across the Middle East about their history, and they keep using words such as humiliation and defeat. They say the U.S. and Europe have derided Arab countries and tried to dominate them ever since the invasions of the Crusaders in the Middle Ages. And they say it's still happening in the West Bank, in Iraq, and other places. We return now to reporter Sandy Tolan in Egypt and Jordan, where he explores how these perceptions and the rage they foster shape the region's politics.
Amidst the sense of defeat rooted in the past, there's a powerful desire to gaze back upon historical pride, upon rare victory, be it Salah ad-Din in 1187 or the momentary victory over Israel 786 years later, October 1973. Hundreds of Egyptian children come each school day to the October War panorama in the Cairo suburb of Heliopolis. Flanking the building, Egyptian tanks and missile launchers. Inside, a diorama of model planes and encampments in the Sinai. A booming voice claims that in 1973, Egypt shattered the myth of Israeli air superiority, not mentioning how Israel destroyed the entire Egyptian Air Force only 6 years earlier. Despite official efforts in the Arab world to recall the glory of victory, in the end, this is not what stays with the people.
The Israel Air Force this morning destroyed 8 Egyptian and 7 Iraqi planes. In the Jerusalem sector, Israeli forces have captured the height of Nebi.
Most of the Sinai Peninsula, including Sharm el-Sheikh, is in Israel's hands, as is most of the west bank of the River Jordan, including Jericho.
1967 until the 5th of June, we thought that the Arabs, by hook or by crook, they could convince Israel to let the Palestinian people determine their future.
From Cairo now, across the Sinai Peninsula and the Gulf of Aqaba, up the Pan-Arab Highway to the Jordanian capital, Amman, where three old friends gather in a fifth-floor office. Maunis Razaz, a novelist, recalls the Arab world's most resounding defeat at the hands of Israel, aided by American weapons and support.
They defeated the Arab world in a humiliating way. Nasser was defeated. Jordan lost half of its kingdom. Syria was defeated. All the Arabs were defeated.
This marked the unofficial end of Pan-Arabism, the quest for one Arab nation championed by Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, a man many considered a latter-day Salah ad-Din. Maunis and the friends that sit with him now, 34 years later, Hani Harani and Mazen Saqat, kept working toward it, aligning themselves out of convenience with the socialist bloc because it supported the Arabs. Jailed and exiled, the men, over time, were worn down while they watched Nasser's authoritarian model of Arab unity, independent of the West, be replaced by dictatorships aligned with the United States.
They built up a big bureaucracy and they became more and more authoritarian leaders. Unfortunately, we have Abdel Nasser model without Nasserism, without the progressive phase of that. We have some model of Sadat or Mubarak. Only they are taking the power, or the model of Saddam Hussein or Hafez al-Assad or Muammar al-Khazafi. Those people who are raising big slogans and achieving few things and ignoring the people. This is the problem on the Arab world.
Secularism and pan-Arabism were assassinated by America and the West in general in the war of 67, then the war of 73, and then the war of 91 against Iraq. In these wars, the result of them was the end of secularism in the area and the support of Muslim movements.
In this analysis, political Islam, including extremists like bin Laden, emerged from a suppression of secular opposition movements, a suppression by Arab governments supported by the United States. Unable to express themselves openly, many flowed to the mosque, making it the venue of opposition politics. Men flow out of a mosque and into the sunshine of a narrow street. It's just after Friday prayer in a poor section of Amman. The loudspeakers of this mosque have been turned off, an increasingly common practice since September 11th. This way, no one in the neighborhood can hear the message of the imam. Across Amman, hundreds of these preachers have been replaced by others approved by the government with a tamer message for the people. These measures are part of the Jordanian government's attempts to curb the growing influence of the mosque on politics. Now the government-approved imam emerges to tell us one thing and one thing only, that Islam is a religion of peace. But the presence of a Westerner and a woman translator without a headscarf has drawn a crowd. It encircles us. The men grow agitated. What is it we want? We want to know how you see America, we say. America, says a man in the crowd. You know justice only if it belongs to you, but you don't know justice if it belongs to someone else.
Israel is killing in Palestine every day for 53 years. What do you call this?
Why are you not calling terrorism this?
What do you call this in America?
This man is from Jerusalem. But he says he cannot go there.
It is my city. It is not a Jewish city. It is my city. My grandfather and my father and I was born in Jerusalem. Why is it Dubai? Do you agree? The Arab nation to Dubai, USA? No.
The government imam turns to the translator. I advise you, he says, to get him out of here. Leave right now. For many in the Arab world, there seem to be but two choices, aligning with the West, and now the war on terrorism, or siding with a radicalized vision of Islam. But millions occupy a vast middle ground, and they want neither choice provided by the West or the extremists. Often, they feel lost.
It is like a kind of another ghetto.
Sausan Darwasa is a Jordanian playwright and producer. Her theme, Arab identity.
It has to be a kind of accumulation of wars, of misunderstandings, of instability. Probably it comes a long time ago. And of course it affects the heart and the mind. Keeps you all the time on the defensive, and it hinders you from really creating freely.
The playwright looks up from her swivel chair. Tomorrow she leaves early for Carthage to put on another production, though lately she's not sure why she bothers.
For myself, I felt that it is a waste. All these efforts, all these books, all these plays, all these songs, all what we have done has come, you know, to a frozen picture for me.
Who is to blame for these broken dreams? Is it just the West?
We're all angry, but I can't help thinking we have also a lot to be blamed for.
Another group around another table in Amman. First names only here, Hania, Muhammad, Hala, Luma, Walid. Since September 11th, there's a new penal code. It's now a crime to print anything in the newspapers that could be judged to damage Jordan's reputation.
And funny, I mean, most people who are persecuted in our part of the world end up going to the U.S. or to the West for protection or to live some kind of a decent life. So we also have to point the finger at ourselves. Does this anger get us anywhere? No, it doesn't.
We have to respect each other, Walid says. We, the West, us. For the group gathered here, these are words from a faraway world. The reality in Jordan is that the much-heralded peace treaty with Israel has brought scant economic benefit. Tourism is nearly dead, unemployment is high. So, just like in Egypt, the anger in Jordan builds, and the chief targets are Israel and the U.S.
People don't like the U.S. because of what the U.S. is doing in the rest of the world. It's American F-15s, American cluster bombs, American missiles, and American bullets that are killing children all over.
People in the Middle East were still willing to give it a try to get the West to understand them. Now simply no one cares anymore. The attitude is becoming more and more to hell with the West.
We start feeding the cycle of hatred. We managed for a while to get a good part of the society out of this cycle that, okay, let's give things a chance. Not all Israelis are bad. Not all Americans are bad. But then when you see all that is happening, you start saying, okay, what did we really get for our goodwill? You know, my God, they hate us. They hate us and they'll always hate us. They don't even look at us as human beings. So screw them, you know, we're gonna hate them.
Traveling in the Arab world, this deepening sense of pessimism is inescapable. The deaths in Palestine and Iraq pile up on television, national economies lie in the dumps, the suppression of speech and political opposition stifles hopes for democratic participation. The emotions of the street are rage and despair.
We will not solve the issue of terrorism by only dealing with terrorists, but also with dealing with the world society that eventually breeds terrorism.
The Arab political analyst Mohammed Sid Ahmed.
The extreme expression of conflict against the system is terrorism. It is people so desperate that they believe that they're dead anyhow. And why should others live when they are dead? Hitting at the others alive is a way to protest against the fact that they are condemned to be dead. This is a very dangerous equation. When despair reaches that point, it's a world destroying itself.
A scattering of European tourists at the stone tunnel of the Crusader Castle in southern Jordan. The castle was captured by Salah ad-Din just before his reconquest of Jerusalem. An old man in robe and keffiyeh stands near the edge of the castle. From here you can look out to Palestine and toward the Mediterranean beyond. If only, he says, if only we could have another Salah ad-Din. Be careful, another man had warned me. Don't ask the old man too many questions. He's grown more and more angry. Lately, he's gone into the Islamist camp, thinking dangerous things.
We were pained by the loss of the thousands of innocents in the World Trade Center. But we have tens of thousands who have died. And maybe what happened in the United States will help people in America to understand how we have been feeling for many, many years.
I'm Sandy Tolan for NPR News and American Radio Works.